you. We want to remember that because of the way it's set up, where March has five Sundays, and then the first class day of April is a Wednesday. So our new quarter will not start until April 7th. That's 2 weeks from today. So just keep that in mind. And so April 7th will be our turnaround, our change-up of classes. So as we were talking about in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, we were talking about how Paul gets into this boasting match. And it's kind of interesting how this lays out. Number one, you have at the very beginning, as we'll see once the chart comes up, you have this boasting by these Judaizers that Paul matches, which is not really anything you should boast in. It's kind of like saying, you know, I'm American, right? I'm part of the United States of America. Well, you were born here. That's not a great accomplishment because you really had no choice of it. You were just born into it. You had really nothing to do with that. So, Paul starts this boasting match, which again, remember, he calls foolishness. Hey, stop that. And so here we go. Paul says, they boast about being Hebrews. Paul says, I'm also a Hebrew. They boast about being an Israelite. Paul says, I'm an Israelite also. They boast about being children of Abraham. Paul says, I also am a child of Abraham. And those are the things I'm talking about. There's nothing to boast in because they haven't accomplished anything. This is just the luck of the draw. They were born into the Hebrew, Israelite, Abrahamic family. And so what we really get down to is where they're boasting about being servants of Christ. And Paul says, remember, I am a servant of Christ even more so. And this is where we get to the real boasting comparison, and that is the evidence. Where's the evidence of them being a servant of Christ and the super apostles? Well, we're going to take a look at that. But Paul says, hey, I'll give you my evidence. I'll give you my resume. And he has plenty of it. And so we talked about this Wednesday night, all these things that he mentions that are all what? Outwardly. They are all physical, right? Some of them are mentioned in the book of Acts. Some of them are not. And so we have, in a sense, some new revelation here about things that happened to Paul that Luke did not deem necessary to tell us as he talked about the story of Paul. Now, in addition to that, Paul also divides this as to, and of course, what are all these things on his resume? They're all things that he was willing to put up with, things he was willing to suffer with, because he was a servant of Christ and an apostle. So obviously, they could not say the same things. Paul mentions a division of all the physical things he suffered. But look as well at chapter 11 and beginning in verse 28 and 29. There he writes, and apart from such external things, physical things, outward things, there is the daily pressure on me of concern for all the churches. Who is weak without my being weak? Who is led into sin without my intense concern? So this gives us a little insight as to Paul. when Paul wasn't teaching the gospel, when he wasn't out there physically teaching and having Bible studies with people, what was Paul doing? Well, a lot of what Paul was doing was thinking about and getting information about how churches were doing, and then, you know, worrying about them and praying for them and writing letters to them to help them out to grow in the Lord. And so he says, even beyond these external physical things, I suffer with these worries and cares and concerns about these other churches. And that's something that is kind of unique to the apostles. In our day and age, we don't do a lot of talking or thinking about other congregations. We announce their gospel meetings or their lady Bible studies and things like that. Sometimes we'll, especially close, we'll find out that a brother over at Tustin or another congregation is in need of some serious prayers, and we'll mention that. But we don't do a whole lot of concern and care for other congregations. We just kind of focus on ourselves. But Paul, in his spare time, did a lot of thinking and a lot of concern for these churches. And so he mentions that as well. So how would the Judaizers, these false slash super apostles, compare to Paul? Well, obviously what he is saying is their resume would not look the same way. And he doesn't mention really anything specifically about them. We're just supposed to assume they don't match up. But I wanted to present a little something of what could we think about these Judaizers. Did they suffer the same way? Were they willing to suffer the same way? What would be the reality if the Judaizers were boasting in reality? And so I put this together. Let's go over to Acts 15 to establish all of this. Keep your place here in 2 Corinthians 11. Go over to Acts 15. Does Acts 15 ring a bell to anyone? Maybe you got to get there first. What's the story of Acts 15? What's going on here? Yeah, what we often call is the Jerusalem Council, right? Where we have this meeting with the elders and the apostles down in Jerusalem. And what's the whole issue? Gentiles. Yeah, no problem.
Whether they had to first become Jews.
Right. Well, this issue that we have entitled the Judaizing issue, that's a title we've come up with to label it. The Bible doesn't ever label them that way. But so we're dealing with these Judaizers, and they get down to Jerusalem to discuss this. And look, if you would, at verses 3 and 4. Therefore, being sent on their way by the church, they were passing through both Phoenicia and Samaria, describing in detail the conversion of the Gentiles, and were bringing great joy to all the brethren. And when they arrived at Jerusalem, they were received by the church and the apostles and the elders, and they reported all that God had done with them. But some of the sect of the Pharisees, that's what I want to emphasize, some from the sect of the Pharisees who had believed stood up saying, "It is necessary to circumcise them and to direct them to observe the law of Moses." And so there is evidence that many of these Judaizers, I won't say all of them, but many of these Judaizers were Pharisees who became Christians. And that might kind of floor us on one end to think that all that we read about the Pharisees in the Gospels, that actually some became Christians, but it's a reality. They did. But they didn't go far enough. They kept those Pharisaical ideas and traditions. And so even though they accepted Christ, they would not give up the law of Moses. And they wouldn't give up those traditions that they just constantly went head to head with Jesus about. And so you have the Pharisees becoming Christians, but they become a division. They split off. And like I said before, they start trying, not really to form their own churches, but to take over the churches of the apostles. That's what they did to Paul when Paul left Galatia. They went in there and they stirred the pot. That's what they did in Corinth when Paul left there. They went in there and stirred the pot. And perhaps some other places like Ephesus and Colossae. And they came up with their own apostles. And that's the people that Paul's dealing with. So, knowing what we know about the Pharisees, what could we see about what they would boast in? What kind of men were these Judaizers? Well, Luke chapter 16 and in verse 14, let's go over there. Jesus gives a parable. And the Pharisees recognize Jesus is talking about them. And they don't like it. And so Jesus delivering these words in this parable. Look if you would at verse 14. Actually, let's look at 13 and 14, put a little of the context. This is where Jesus says, "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to the one, despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth." Now, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. And so Luke tells us that these Pharisees, they were lovers of money. In addition to that, Matthew 23, let's go over to Matthew 23. And in verse 6, where Jesus tells us, again about the Pharisees, that they love the place of honor at the banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues, the respectful greetings in the marketplaces, and being called rabbi by men. And then look, if you would, at verse 4 and 5. But they tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. But they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments. And so, using what we have in the Gospels about the Pharisees, knowing that many of these Judaizers were Pharisees, it gives us kind of a good comparison of what Paul mentions versus what we could expect of these super false apostles. Doesn't what we have back here kind of fit with what we're expecting, what Paul's hinting at? Paul goes through all of these sufferings, even being without money, being homeless, being shipwrecked, and what kind of men are these? They like the wealth. They like the good life. They like the recliners, right? And to relax and be honored and to have the easy life. And so Paul's trying to get the Corinthians to kind of look at the reality here. Which one seems more Christ-like? And so as we go back to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. What you understand about these Judaizers, it really does make that comparison, that in the end, they really fell because they're nothing like Paul. Their commitment to Jesus is very weak. It's more of a commitment to themselves and the old law. So one of the things we've been talking about is why were these Corinthians turning against Paul, who baptized many of them into Christ, and others he taught and brought to Christ and let others baptize them. And we have that explained to us in this chapter 10 and chapter 11 we talked about. But it presents a good lesson. Why would brethren turn on one another today? And it happens sometimes, doesn't it? Brethren turn on one another. Or maybe a brother starts attacking another brother, and the brother being attacked is just like, what's going on here? Well, there's a number of reasons why this does happen, why this can happen. But we want to look at a few that kind of are pertinent to what we have in this situation. Number one, sometimes a brother might turn against another brother simply because there's a desire for recognition and praise. And unfortunately, this is a sinful desire because it comes with this idea that not only do I need to elevate myself and let people know how great I am so that they will recognize and praise me, but there's this kind of this feeling that I can't let anyone else be recognized or praised, and so I've got to tear them down. And that's usually why, in this situation, this motivation, there's a brother or two or three that get attacked. Diotrephes in 3 John verse 9. Remember what it says about Diotrephes and what he loved? What did Diotrephes love? What's that? He loved to praise a man. Yeah, he loved to be first. He loved to be first. And so he kind of took over the church. And what was one of the problems John addresses in those verses? He doesn't do what we say. He doesn't follow what we write. So here's Diotrephes. He loves to be first, and part of being first is to tear down and to ignore John the Apostle and his authority. And in fact, John writes about certain brethren, and instead of taking what John says and welcoming these brethren, Diotrephes did what? Kicked them out. That's a perfect example of what we're talking about here. What are these Judaizers doing to Paul? They're making these accusations. They're tearing him down. They want the Corinthians to hate him. Why? Because they want the recognition. And they feel like they can't get the recognition and the praise and the following of the Corinthians unless they tear Paul down. Another one. King Saul. King Saul was an example of this in the sense that he wanted to be recognized by God as being faithful. But at a certain point, he was only willing to be faithful to God if he could, what, get the recognition and the praise of men. And so Samuel came one day to King Saul and says, what is this bleeding of sheep I hear? And he said, oh, well, I let the people take... He doesn't even say it that way. He doesn't say, I let the people... He says, oh, the people took some of the sheep because they're going to sacrifice to God. And he says, you haven't been faithful to God. He says, yeah, I have. I went and attacked the Amalekites. And Samuel says, no, you didn't do what God said. God says to utterly destroy and not leave anything alive. And Saul's just like, I can't understand that. Because Saul tried to serve two masters, right? He's gonna serve God, but only if he can have the favor of the people. And so sometimes he obeys the people, and he sometimes obeys God. And you get into kind of this half and half thing. So in this example, who is it that King Saul is attacking or tearing down? It's God. Yeah, in this situation, David's not even involved yet. So it's God. And we can end up doing that. So why do brethren turn on? Well, one of it is because of this very thing. I remember this particular church that didn't have elders, and they were doing men's business meetings. And there was one particular brother that really enjoyed the men's business meeting because he got to stand up and he got to say, I think we need to do this and I think we need to do that. And his voice was heard and he was recognized. And sometimes they say, hey, that's a great idea. And then they came to a point where they're like, we've got to appoint elders. We've got men qualified. And so they started that process. And guess what? He wasn't qualified, so he was left off the list and he became very upset. He's a... Brethren, things are going fine without elders. We do not need elders. And he fought it tooth and nail. And it wasn't that they were trying to get him off of his, you know, his voice. He could still let the elders know what he thought was good and what wasn't good and all that. But he took it as, I'm going to lose my position. And so they went ahead and appointed elders because that was the scriptural thing to do. And so he left the church. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly... Why is this going... Because of pride. You're exactly right. He wanted that recognition, that praise, and he felt, if we have elders, I'm going to lose all that. And so in that sense, he tore down the whole church because, and especially the elders... Because he wanted to be, what? Recognized and praised. There's another reason. The grass is greener on the other side. You know, when you're involved in whatever it be, a church, a family, a business, right? You're involved in the good and you're involved in the bad. And sometimes you look at other companies or you look at other churches and you're like, you don't get to see the bad. Sometimes you just see the good. Oh, the grass is greener over there. There was someone like that in the Old Testament. His name was Ahithophel. Anyone remember him? Not a character we spent a lot of time talking about. He was one of the chief counselors to David. And he was with David early on. He was faithful to David until Absalom came on the scene. Remember, Absalom wanted to steal the kingdom? Well, for some reason, Ahithophel thought, you know, things are going to be better with Absalom on the throne. And so when Absalom planned his coup attempt over his father David, Ahithophel left David, betrayed David, and went over to Absalom and started advising Absalom how he could defeat his father, the king, King David. The grass was greener with Absalom until God came involved and Absalom was driven out. And so was Ahithophel. And I think eventually Ahithophel in his downfall actually committed suicide. Once all the grass was not greener and the coup attempt was put out, he eventually took his own life. What about Judas? It's always amazing to me because Judas received everything that Peter received, that James received, that John received, that all the apostles received. He got the same teaching as all the apostles. He witnessed the same power and miracles, but somehow the grass was greener when it came to that the green stuff, right? The coinage. And so that's what he was after. And so because this was so much better, who did he turn on? Yeah, he turned on Jesus. First he stole from him, right? And then he betrayed him. And isn't it interesting, what did he go out and do once it all came to a fruition? He went out and killed himself. So, we sometimes brethren turn on one another because, the grass is greener, something's better out there. And so to justify going to the green grass, you've got to what? You've got to set up, there's a problem here, that's why I'm leaving. There really is not a problem. You're just creating that problem because you think this is better. And that's where I want to be. Sometimes in churches, brethren will attack a brother because, I've got to have an excuse to go to this church. Instead of just leaving, I got to find, so my conscience feels better, right? And so that's one of the reasons why brethren turn on one another. And then thirdly, sometimes because they're just too weak and timid to stand up. This often happens where maybe a brother is attacking a brother and no one does anything. No one stands up and says, what's going on here? So I remember a church one time where there was a couple brethren that decided, hey, we don't like the way things are going. We're going to attack the elders. And we're going to try to get rid of the elders. And I mean, they chose the most unchristlike way to do it. It was ugly, ugly, ugly. And the brethren just were too weak and too timid. And they just let these brethren walk all over them. No one stood up and said anything. So, very, very sad. That's kind of what Paul is saying about the Corinthians. Look at chapter 11, verse 4. Chapter 11, verse 4. He says of the Corinthians, "For if one comes and preaches another Jesus whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully." No one in Corinth is standing up and saying, hey, let's think about this. Let's talk about it. This is not right. Look, if you would, later on in chapter 11 and verse 19 and 20. For you being so wise, tolerate the foolish gladly. For you tolerate if someone enslaves you, anyone devours you, anyone takes advantage of you, anyone exalts himself, anyone hits you in the face, he says. So here's a situation where this is allowed to go on because no one's standing up saying this isn't right. So those are a few things that kind of come across here that connect with what we're talking about. We could talk about Peter as well, but let's move on. So having to defend yourself to your friends, it's an awful thing to have friends, and your brethren should be your friends, turn against you. Or just have friends that have been close to you turn against you. It's an awful thing. A friend is one you shouldn't have to defend yourself to, but here's Paul having to do that. Imagine that. So these are the times God really tests us. This is where it really gets challenging to be a Christian. When you have a friend, when you have a brother, when you have a spouse, when you have a parent that is turning on you, doing things that you're just like, I can't understand. This is not the person I know. This is not Christ-like. What is going on here? Well, that's where you're really tested. Because as bad as they are behaving, as un-Christ-like as they are, what does it demand of you? You've got to do what's right, even though it's hard. You've got to take the high road, even though it's difficult. And so the closer you are to the one that's persecuting you, the more challenging it is. But does it change how you react to it? No. You still got to do the right thing. It's easy to tell someone to do that. It's not as easy to actually do it. But that's where, you know, you do what's right and you let God figure out when it's all going to come, that which is crooked, and when God's going to make it straight. And sometimes it's that waiting for God's answer and waiting for God to get involved that's hard. It's difficult when a friend turns against you. But if you're not doing the right thing when God's ready, then maybe God can't straighten that which is crooked. Because maybe part of what God does to straighten it is using you. So that's why it's important, though it's challenging. So Paul had behaved in such a way that he could bring those who made such a charge to shame. And this is what we really see here. The fact that he's able to boast in these things, which he doesn't want to, he thinks they're foolishness, right? That really, when you look at it like we've done side by side, those Judaizers just look pathetic. They just look ridiculous standing up there and saying they're the super apostles. And that's the way that we need to handle such situations. That's the way we need to defend ourselves. Let's go to 2 Corinthians and Titus chapter 2. We're already 2 Corinthians. Titus chapter 2. In Titus chapter 2, look at what Paul writes, verse 7 and 8. In all things, so show yourself to be an example of good deeds, with purity in doctrine, dignified, sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. See what Paul says? You've got to live the Christian life. You've got to take the high road, even though it's challenging. That's how we defend ourselves. And I know you've all been in your life in a situation like that. And maybe you haven't been perfect. That's where we get that grace of God and we get the second chance to rebound. But I think that's a really good lesson that comes out of what we're talking about here. Any comments or questions? Anything you want to share before we move on? Okay. All right. So let's get into now chapter 12. I put chapter 12 with chapter 11 because it's really just a continuation. Paul's not done boasting. But you think you're impressed with Paul's resume as an apostle? Wait till you see what he talks about in chapter 12. So Paul has been boasting in the flesh to defend his apostleship, what he calls foolishness. He has been boasting in his sufferings, both physical, outward, and also inward, spiritually. But now what's Paul going to boast in? Well, one of the things about being an apostle is that you on occasion get visions and revelations. And Paul says, I can boast about that. And there's lots of things he could have boasted in. You can go back in the book of Acts and you can see a few times where Jesus comes to him. In fact, one of the times that Jesus came to Paul was when he was at Corinth in the initial visit. Go back to Acts chapter 18, if you would. Acts chapter 18, this is where he started the church. And look at verse 9. Acts 18, verse 9. Things are apparently going really well. We learn that a leader of the synagogue has become a Christian, that many are following or listening to Paul. And then, verse 9, and the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you. For I have many people in this city. So, there's lots of times that Jesus came and revealed himself and spoke directly to Paul. And one of those times was at Corinth. But Paul doesn't use any of those. Instead, he uses one that he's not even really allowed to talk about. So go over to Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 1. Paul continues, boasting is necessary, though it is not what? Profitable. You see that? It's necessary in this, but it's not profitable. But I will go on now to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man who in Christ 14 years ago, whether in the body I do not know, or out of the body I do not know, God knows, such a man was caught up to the third heaven. And I know how such a man, whether in the body or apart from the body, I do not know. God knows. He was caught up into paradise, and he heard inexpressible words which a man is not permitted to speak. On behalf of such a man, I will boast. But on my own behalf, I will not boast, except in regard to my weakness. For if I do wish to boast, I will not be foolish, for I will be speaking the truth. But I refrain from this, so that no one will credit me with more than he sees in me or hears from me. So, Paul talks about this man who was taken up into heaven. Who's the man? Yeah. But notice, it's almost like Paul doesn't want to say it was him. He doesn't want anyone to think this is something that I did. He said, here's this man, and it happened to this man. And this is what happened to this man. And so even in the way he describes the event, he's talking about himself, but he talks about himself as a man. Almost like in the third person, like sometimes people like to do. And so, one of the things about this vision, this revelation, is it was so magnificent that Paul was kind of confused. And what was one of the things he's not sure about?
Whether it happened physically or just spiritually, like in a trance.
Yeah. Whether this really happened to him in the body, or if it was just a vision. And so over and over he says, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows. But one thing he does know is that this experience was so real. It was real. But it's not something that happens to anyone every single day. And so he makes it very clear, I don't know if I was in the body or out of the body. I don't know if this was a vision or if this actually happened to me physically. Okay? And so Paul boasts about going into the third heaven, which in verse 4, the third heaven is called what? Paradise. And while Paul was up there, he heard inexpressible words which a man is not permitted to speak. Which is kind of funny, because if they're inexpressible, I don't know how he would speak them. But it just, what Paul is trying to say is that there's this glory in heaven that we don't even understand, that we can't even describe or express. And of course, Paul is going to elaborate on this to show how great this was, not because of him, but because of what happened to him, that God actually allows something to happen to Paul to keep him from boasting about it. And that's what we're going to talk about next week, this vision, or Wednesday, and this thorn in the flesh. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you're going to talk about that next time, I don't want to get ahead.
Okay. Are you working Wednesday?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to say, there's an argument to be made, some like good argument, that this part of the thorn in the flesh, that Paul had experienced part of heaven, and yet he was still living on earth. He had these knowledge of things, this knowledge of what heaven is like to some degree, but was confined to earth with all these terrible things.
Yeah. That's quite possible that's exactly what the thorn in the flesh is, right? Yeah. All right, so we'll stop there and pick up Wednesday night. Thank you.